You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Welcome to Brookings. My name is Tamar Manuel Yanatinch, and I'm a visiting fellow here at Brookings. And I'm delighted to have the opportunity to moderate our discussion this afternoon. We're very fortunate to have the occasion to hear about and discuss the Netherlands' new agenda for aid, trade, and investment. Now, you might ask, why is this important? Although, since you have shown up, I'm assuming that you're interested in finding out about this. What I wanted to say is, when an exemplary global citizen, such as the government of Netherlands, makes a fundamental change in the way it approaches its international partners, I think it is important to take note and try and understand why and what that means. It might also portend things to come from other like-minded countries. So why do I say Netherlands is an exemplary global citizen? Just a few facts to make the case. I think Netherlands, as many of you will know, is one of the world's most open economies, with imports and exports as a share of GDP above 70% each. Netherlands' ODA as a percent of GNI is above the DAC EU average at 0.75%. And along with a handful of like-minded donor countries, and it is really a handful, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and Luxembourg, Netherlands exceeds the UN target for aid of 0.7%. Netherlands also does very well on the Commitment to Development Index developed by the Center for Global Development, and I think we're going to be hearing more about that. This index rates governments along seven dimensions, including aid, trade, and investment, but also migration, environment, security, and technology. Netherlands ranks sixth among 27 countries on this index, and specifically on aid effectiveness, which assesses not just the volume of assistance, but its quality. It ranks fifth. I hope I got that right.
Yeah, I couldn't remember myself.
So now it is my pleasure to introduce the Minister for Foreign Trade and Development Corporation of the Kingdom of the Netherlands. Minister Lilian Ploumen was appointed as Minister for Foreign Trade and Development Cooperation on November 5, 2012. So she's been on the job not quite 1 year yet. And her interesting career really spans politics, government, and non-governmental organizations. She was chair of the Labour Party from October 2007 to January 2012. Before that, from 2001 to 2007, the minister worked for the development organization Cordate, first as head of quality and strategy and later as director of international programs. In 1995, she founded Ploumen Projecten, an organization specializing in market research and innovation for commercial and nonprofit clients. In the same year, she also began working as a fundraising coordinator for, and I love the name, Mama Cash, an international fund supporting women's initiatives, going on to become director of the organization from 1996 to 2001. I will stop there. I believe you have her longer resume in front of you, and I won't take any more time from the remarks that she's going to make. So the minister will make some remarks, then I will introduce our panelists, who will each have 5 minutes to discuss, comment on the minister's presentation, and then I will ask each individual a question and then open it up for comments and questions from all of you from the floor. Madam Minister.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for being here for your interest in the new policy of the Netherlands. The Netherlands has always been in the forefront of what you could call international cooperation, partly because, as was mentioned, we're a very open economy. We very much depend on our relations with other countries, other continents, partly because we've been very innovative in the way that we were looking at international relations. And When early 70s, the debate started around official development assistance, it was one of my predecessors, Jan Pronk, who really initiated that debate and came up with what we now know to be the ODA norm. Times are changing, though. Bob Dylan, it's a Bob Dylan song, I think, from the 70s, but the world has been changing since then, and now there's a new era. And let me first say a few words on how I see the world as it has been as it has been changing for the past decade. 10 years ago, I think it was that The Economist portrayed Africa as the lost continent. And, of course, no one at the continent felt lost or at a loss because many people in Africa were struggling for their to maintain a day-to-day life that was acceptable to them and to try and send their children to school. But the perception of the world was that Africa was a lost continent. There were wars, conflicts, no economic development, etc., etc. Now, 7 out of the 10 fastest-growing economies for the next decade are from Africa. So the whole concept of what Africa is, and many of our development efforts have been targeted at Africa, so what Africa is really, really changing. And you can see it. I was in Uganda, in Kampala, a few weeks ago, and I think I was there in 2005. And it changed tremendously, tremendously. People were not walking barefoot anymore through the streets of Kampala. They were wearing slippers or even shoes. The buildings were 3 or 4 stories high. There was a lot of entrepreneurial activity going on. So it's not only what you see in the statistics, it's also what you see on the streets in Africa. I will come back to this point because not everything has changed for the better, obviously. There's lots to be done. But so 7 out of 10 fastest growing economies are in Africa, one. Second, look at a country like Brazil. 15 years ago, I was there as a director of a development organization discussing with NGOs on how to work together to combat poverty in Brazil. And last December, I was there as head of a trade mission of Dutch entrepreneurs. In that week, we were like the 7th trade mission. So the French were there and the Germans and probably the Americans. That perception of what Brazil is has also changed because when we went there with that trade mission, we were the beggars and Brazil were the choosers. So Brazil, India, Turkey, South Africa, they have really changed the dynamics of their economy. I spoke with President Lula a couple of years ago, and he said, well, there's this misconception in the West, both in Europe as well as in the United States, where you continue to speak about Brazil as an emerging country, but you're making a mistake. Brazil has already emerged. So that's the second. Then the third is that looking at the dynamics of the European economy, looking at the dynamics of the European politics, that's also changing. We don't have any double-digit growth numbers anymore within the Eurozone. We are in trouble, one could say. The Dutch economy is one of the strongest in the Eurozone, structurally speaking, at least. Our position in the world has also been changing. And in the Netherlands, what you see is that the Dutch, who have been very outward-looking as a way of life, are also very much trying to link up with all those developments in the world. And they really have this feeling that the world is changing and that we need to adapt to that. Now, those developments really cater for a new agenda on development aid. And I came up with this agenda, which is called a new agenda for aid, trade, and investment, where inclusive growth, inclusive economic growth, is the key word. And we are stepping away, if you wish, from the traditional aid, where we work from government to government, supplying funding for education or infrastructure or other social sectors. And we want to cooperate in creating an environment that is both interesting for entrepreneurial activities, both locally, regionally, and internationally, and where everyone can participate in that economy. I think the term inclusive is key here. So one of the key elements of this new policy will be to work on an enabling environment for private sector. And working at an enabling environment for private sector, that's a real broad range of activities, going from supporting the International Land Coalition, which assists people in their negotiating power towards multinational companies and to prevent those companies from land grabbing, to working on customs union and regional economic development. This agenda, I must say, has been warmly welcomed by many, many African politicians, African citizens, and it's been a real game changer also in the type of dialogue that I have with, for example, President Museveni or Kagame or any other leader. We used to come there and say, you know, your country is in need and we think that we know what you need and we are also able and willing to provide for that. And now I come and I say, well, you know, I want to talk about economic development. I want to speak about how you engage civil society in economic development, how you want to work with the private sector. And I want to see if there's any way that Dutch investors, Dutch companies can become active in your country. And that caters for a different dialogue, which is much more on an equal footing, if you wish. And that, I would say, is also a sign of the times that we need to respond to. Now, this also means that all sectors of Dutch society should be involved in this new agenda of aid, trade and investment. It's no longer only an agenda for the government or for NGOs or for citizens who are really in solidarity with other countries and other peoples. It's also an agenda for the Dutch private sector. So I invite the Dutch private sector to also engage in countries in Africa and Latin America and Asia, and also to do that in a way which, I mean, one could say is social responsible. And that is, I would say, a prerogative for that agenda to work out well, because the private sector has to take responsibility in being a responsible investor, relating to local communities, think about what local sourcing can bring to communities. One of our companies, you might know them, Heineken, the famous beer brewer, they work in Congo. Congo is a very difficult country to work in. Politically speaking, it's not very stable. There are parts of the country that have been in conflict for a very, very long time. But Heineken manages to come up to percentage of 90% of local sourcing, not only in terms of human resources, but also in terms of all the produce that they need to come up with locally brewed beer. And this is how I see that the private sector should engage in entrepreneurial activities worldwide. I do encourage them to work from out of that framework. That is a struggle sometimes, but I think the Dutch corporate sector is very much into this agenda. So what does that say about the ODA that the Netherlands is still engaged in? We choose to work in four areas for our ODA commitment. One would be food security. There's also an agenda to work with the private sector. Food security. Second would be water. Responsible water management, both in terms of access to water, but also the more political aspects of water management. The third would be peace and security, where we advocate for our 3D approach, which is working from the perspective of development, diplomacy, and defense, and the fourth would be sexual and reproductive rights and rights of women. And those four themes are basically the four themes that where we think that the Netherlands has an added value, where we do things or can do things that other countries are not willing to or not able to. And I think in this agenda for aid, trade and investment, also other countries should be invited to look more into where they can add a specific value instead of spreading out too thin, working in different sectors. Now, let me stop here. This is the outline of the agenda. Obviously, I wrote it down in a very nice policy note. That's what politicians do. I'm sure you can check it at the website of the Dutch embassy. And looking forward to the debate. And if there's any questions that you are not able to post today, make sure that you find me on the mail or on Facebook so we can have a dialogue there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Minister, certainly for the content, but also for sticking to the time frame. I appreciate that. And I hope our panelists have taken note. So let me introduce our fantastic panelists. We're going to start off with David. Is it Rudman or Rudman? I should have
Rudman.
Asked. Rudman. Very good. So David Rudman is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, focusing on a range of issues, including microfinance, debt relief, and aid effectiveness. And I understand that he will soon be joining the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation as a senior economic advisor. Congratulations and good luck with that. Mr. Rudman has written on a broad range of topics, as I said, including microfinance. And I understand the way he went about that was also innovative. Debt, environment, and aid. And among econometricians, Mr. Rodman is best known for his computer programs that run in the statistical software package known as Stata. That has won him the inaugural Stata Journal's Editor Prize in 2012. Also of interest, in 2012, and I like the way this was written, Mr. Rodman aged off the Research Papers in Economics list of top young economists in the world at number 6. Most relevant for this discussion, though, is that Mr. Rudman has been the architect and manager of the Commitment to Development Index since the project's inception in 2012. The index, which I think you'll talk about, ranks the world's richest countries based on their dedication to policies. It's widely recognized as the most comprehensive measure of rich country policies toward the developing world. Mr. Rodman has also written several papers questioning the capacity of common cross-country statistical techniques to shed light on what causes economic development, and it's good to know I'm in good company on that score. He also co-authored a 2004 American Economic Review paper that challenged the findings of World Bank research that aid works in a good policy environment, and I had to mention that having worked at the bank for 28 years, you know that I'm not cutting things out because I'm biased. I also can't resist mentioning that the Japanese edition of his book on the natural wealth of nations harnessing the market for the environment garnered him a selection as one of the outstanding young persons of 2003 by the Osaka Junior Chamber, which led to an audience with the emperor and empress. So he is perfectly ready for this distinguished audience. Here we go.
Oh, my. I encouraged him to radically cut that down, but they didn't. It's great to be here. Actually, one minor correction. I've been working on the Commitment to Development Index since 2002, almost since I started at the Center for Global Development across the street. And I will step down from that responsibility, I guess, in a few days. It's been 11 years. I read over the very nice policy statement that you have developed, and I think this is a place where it's much easier to criticize than to construct, right? Because there's just so much we don't know about which policies will work best in which contexts and what are the right generalizations. And certainly I don't know about the administrative and political constraints that you have to work within. But I did find myself you know, sort of asking critical questions about the theory and evidence behind these particular choices. I think that one thrust, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that aid will go more to fragile states, countries in conflict, the poorest nations, the ones in the most difficulty, and that for middle-income countries such as Brazil, the focus will be more on trade, open trade relations. And, you know, you could ask whether that's backwards. Maybe actually Myanmar will benefit more from an emphasis on trade. I worry about there being too much aid going into Myanmar, and the history in that part of the world is that openness to exports of manufacturers has been a great help in reducing poverty. Meanwhile, with Brazil's fairly competent government, one that's got a track record now of commitment to redistribution, maybe aid would be well used there. So there are a lot of questions that are easier for me to ask than for you to answer.
Wait and see.
Yeah, okay. I also was worried a little bit about what sort of mercantilist emphasis, that there's an interest in promoting Dutch exports, but less mention of making the Dutch economy more open to imports, especially of agriculture from developing countries. So, like I say, there are a lot of imponderables there. The Commitment to Development Index is this system, ranking that comes out each year, which rates rich nations on how well their policies are supporting development and the spread of economic growth and prosperity across the developing world. And so it represents my best attempt to answer some of these questions, and it has all sorts of problems, and you can ask exactly the same kinds of questions of it that I've just asked of you. One of the key messages of that whole project is that helping developing countries is about more than foreign aid. And so I congratulate you on fully embracing and recognizing that message in your work. You're way ahead of the U.S. government in that respect. And I also congratulate you on your government's historical strong performance on the CDI. I think, what is it? It's now fifth or sixth right now, and it historically has been more like third. It has come down a little bit. So just as a way of filling out my few minutes, I just wanted to briefly review what is the factors that have most driven the Dutch performance, both in comparison to other countries and over time, which implies a few areas that I think actually are important for the Dutch government to look at, probably more important than most of what's emphasized in the policy. So, for example, the Dutch government has actually come down a bit on the aid component, and that is because aid as a percentage of GDP has been falling a bit. So the Dutch government, I think, is now ranked at about number 5. On trade, your government is tops in Europe, which is something to be proud of, although arguably that's not a very, you know, it's not saying much, because the common agriculture policy is still creating lots of barriers to imports of agricultural goods from the rest of the world. The Dutch government has really improved on investment over the last 10 years, partly by stepping up its participation in the OECD anti-bribery convention, the Kimberley process, which is meant to reduce corruption in international investment and resource extraction. It has fallen on migration, partly because 10 years ago it had accepted quite a number of refugees and is not doing so as much anymore. It has improved on the environment, I think, partly because of reducing ozone-depleting substances, you know, that deplete the ozone layer. On the other hand, the gap between its economic growth rate and the greenhouse gas emissions growth rate has fallen quite substantially. We'd like to see, well, the best would be for the emissions growth rate to be negative while the economic growth rate is positive, so that there's a big gap. But that gap has actually narrowed. I think in the 1990s there were a lot of progressive policies brought in to support wind and solar, and that progress has in some ways stalled. The government has been strong on funding research and development, which ultimately creates public goods that the whole world can benefit from. And on the other hand, it is, when you talk about exports, you might want to look at Dutch exports of arms. On our measure of arms exports, the Dutch government is fourth worst behind Sweden, France, and Czechoslovakia when it comes to, the Czech Republic, when it comes to exporting weapons to countries that are relatively undemocratic and relatively poor. So implied in that is a much broader agenda, I think, than what you have mentioned, and hopefully can lead to further action.
Great. Thank you very much, David. Okay, our next panelist is Josh Meltzer. Dr. Joshua Meltzer is a fellow in the Global Economy and Development Group here at the Brookings Institution, and he's an adjunct professor at the Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies and at the Georgetown Law School. Dr. Meltzer is also a reviewer of the Journal of Politics and Law. His work focuses on international trade law and policy issues relating to the WTO and free trade agreements. His research also includes the intersection between climate change and international trade and the role of trade policy in supporting access to the internet and cross-border data flows. He also writes on global governance issues with a focus on the legitimacy of the WTO and other international economic bodies such as the G20. Prior to joining Brookings, Dr. Meltzer was a trade negotiator and legal advisor with the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. He was also posted as a diplomat to the Australian Embassy in Washington, D.C., where he was responsible for trade and climate change issues. Josh.
Great, thanks. And thank you, Minister. In my allocated time, I'm just briefly, I think, going to talk a little bit about the framework of the WTO when it comes to development and the link between development and trade. Then I'm going to try to relate it a bit back to your new policy in this respect. I want to start out, though, with one figure. I think there's a lot of good figures out there in terms of progress on development in the last 20 years or so. But the one that I think strikes me is that since 1990, those people living in extreme poverty, defined as $1.25 per day, has fallen from approximately 2 billion people to about 1.4 billion people. So that's, you know, certainly enormous progress. And I think part of that progress has certainly been brought about by the increasing role of trade liberalisation in that context. Now, I don't want to suggest that trade liberalisation alone has driven that or has even been a major factor, and I think it has been a factor. But I think importantly, and I think what this comes out in a lot of the development work that goes on, is that it only really works if it's embedded in part of a more holistic set of policies. So that might include policies as disparate as focusing on education, health, issues to do with governance such as rule of law and corruption. And I think when done appropriately on a tailored country-by-country basis, trade liberalisation can certainly play an important and constructive role when it comes to helping lift countries out of poverty. Now, in the WTO context, the needs, I guess, of developing countries are reflected through largely this concept of special and differential treatment. And this plays out, and actually there's another agenda there which is more recent called Aid for Trade, which I'll also talk about briefly. Now, on the special and differentiated side, this plays out in a number of ways. It can come about in terms of requiring lower tariff reductions from developing countries in terms of market access. The commitments can be phased in over longer periods of time. And I think importantly also on the export side, there is scope within the WTO for developed countries in particular, but also developing countries, to provide preferential market access for exports from developing countries. And this is legally operationalised under what's called the Enabling Clause. There's also another component there, which is more a goal at the moment, which is essentially duty-free, quota-free for least developed countries. Now, I think certainly on the special and differentiated treatment side, there are some challenges there, which I think I'll pick up a little bit when I speak more about the Dutch policy, which is that the growth of large developing countries, and I think in particular we're talking about the BRICS here, has, I think, given rise to a sense in the developed world that we need to be more differentiated when we think about the trade agenda in developing countries. And in fact, in many respects, the challenges with the Doha round reflect, I think, these new challenges that have arisen, particularly from the growth of China, but I think also Brazil, South Africa and others. And if we, in fact, think back to the negotiations in 2007-2008, when the United States was and the EU and others were engaged in so-called sectoral negotiations with China, Brazil, India on industrial products, really with the idea here being more that the developed world had a sense that some developing countries needed to be doing more in the context of the round. And I think this is a key idea which also animates the Dutch policy to some extent. On the Aid for Trade bit, this was launched at the 2005 Hong Kong ministerial meeting. And essentially it's about trying to increase the capacity for developing countries to take advantage of trade liberalisation. So It's about their engagement in the multilateral trading system. It's about the ability for them to benefit from it. And it looks at supply-side constraints. So it looks at infrastructure. It looks at issues relating to how customs works. These are through trade facilitation. And their ability, for instance, to respond and to comply with international standards or SPS requirements. And it's about really getting the regulatory and business environment right so that developing countries can take advantage of the new market access opportunities that come about through trade liberalisation. Now, when I look at the new Dutch policy, for me it seems to really build on this framework by essentially having a more tailored and nuanced approach to the way that the developed world and the way that the Dutch are going to engage with the developing world and use trade as a vehicle for promoting development. So we see a differentiated approach to developing countries, and we see also an emphasis, I think, on what you call the enabling environment for businesses in developing countries. Now, I think that what we have is we have sort of an aid and trade component, which is a combination of aid and using trade to encourage development for fragile states and for particularly for developing countries in particular challenging situations, and for those developing countries which are growing and which are beginning to have a more emergent middle class. So we can talk about countries like Colombia and India and Mexico, for instance. We see a role for a more commercial trade and investment relationship between these countries and Dutch businesses. Now, I actually think this is important for a couple of reasons. I think one of them is that it's just recognising the reality that developing countries are going to themselves be important drivers of global growth, and that there are going to be opportunities out there. And in fact, and the opportunities are multifaceted. I think that on one hand, just simply selling more final goods and services into these developing countries in and of itself can, if done appropriately, raise consumer welfare. But I think actually even more importantly than that is that there is a recognition now that the pathway to integration in the world economy is becoming part of global supply chains. And the way that you become part of a global supply chain is you do a couple of things. You make sure that you have this enabling environment, but also you reduce your barriers to imports. Because what that's going to mean is that you're going to have to be importing in order to export. And I think that the Dutch policy actually can build on that by not only encouraging new market access opportunities for exports from these countries, but also encouraging the reduction of imports. And I think done appropriately, this can sort of help integrate these countries more into the global supply chain and be positive for development on that front as well. Just briefly, I mean, I think on the trade policy front, we have, though, got some important challenges. And I'll just mention two very briefly. I think on the WTO front, clearly, the stalling of the Doha round is difficult for developing countries. It's a development agenda. And, David, you've spoken about, the agricultural issue. It's true for the EU. It's true for the United States and Japan and other large developed countries who need to obviously phase out subsidies and open up their agricultural markets and the other opportunities that exist. And there's also the move to free trade agreements and the mega free trade agreements. We've got we're going to have the launch of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership negotiations in July in Washington very shortly. And this is going to there was actually a report out by the Bertelsmann Stiftung recently, which basically said that in the event of an ambitious outcome on this free trade agreement agenda, there's going to be welfare reductions in the developing world. And this is the trade diversion effect. So, and I think this is a challenge. This is not saying that this free trade agreement shouldn't go ahead, because it should, because there's very good reasons for doing it. But I think for the EU, for the United States, and for other developed countries, I think the trade agenda also raises these challenges of how do they manage the developing country implications of them as well. I think I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, Josh. So in the next segment, and I'd like to take about 15 minutes for that so we can give the audience time as well in the next segment. So I get to ask the panelists questions to get us started. And Madam Minister, I had two questions for you, but one of which you've already addressed to some extent in your remarks, And that had to do with the reactions to the new strategy from different stakeholders. You talked about the reactions you received from some African leaders as well as the business constituency in the Netherlands. If you could also touch upon your discussions with some of the middle income or emerging economies and how this was received, given that they will be getting less of the aid, plus civil society, because there is clearly in the note statements that there will be a decline in the support that is provided to civil society. So that was the first question. The second one, more on the sectors of focus in the new strategy as compared to what you have done so far. I guess over the years, and I've been in development for about 30 years now, I've been struck by the interrelated nature of development challenges, which of course should not be an excuse for not having a strategic focus, but it certainly makes it difficult to exercise strategic selectivity. So I'm always impressed when I see agencies, organizations actually taking that on in earnest and having a strategic focus. But I have a question on your thematic priorities. So your note says that you will be phasing out of your cross-cutting themes, which included the themes of good governance, the environment, and education in low and middle-income countries. Yet your new areas of focus, which you did mention, food security, water, women's rights and reproductive and health rights, and security and rule of law, have very close links with those cross-cutting issues. There's certainly links between food security and water and the environment, links between the rule of law and good governance, of course, between education and women's rights. So I just wanted to see if you could explain a little bit the thinking that went behind these changes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Also, thank you very much for your critical and constructive remarks, which I hope I will be able to address later on. Maybe to start with your last question around the importance of having a strategic focus, but also what that means for what we've been calling cross-cutting themes. Like you, and like you already, as you already mentioned, I've been active in the development world for quite some time, and one of the things that I have been thinking about all that time is how some issues get attention in our global agenda, and how some never get attention. In other words, how some issues are hyped, if you wish, and others are not. Now, this whole concept of cross-cutting themes and mainstreaming was the talk of the town, well, maybe 20 years ago. And I have never been a strong believer in it, actually, because I do see the interconnectedness. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But in practice, what does it mean to mainstream gender, for example? I'm a strong women's rights activist, so, I mean, there's no doubt about my commitment to the cause here. But what does it mean when we say that we're going to mainstream gender? Now, some very unwilling bureaucrats have to tick boxes on that they really consider the impact of their policies on women and men and relationships between the two. Now, was this a really thought-through exercise? Was this something that they were really committed to? Yeah, sometimes, yeah, but most of the time it wasn't. It became a bureaucratic exercise. The same on the topic of good governance. That was the talk of the town 10 years ago. Now, good governance is very important, but I think it's much more important to include it in the four themes that I have. For example, if you speak about private sector development, it is about customs, it is about transparency, and good governance in terms of water is about how we assist communities to take charge of their own water supply and their own water management. So I'm not very much a fan of all these cross-cutting and mainstreaming strategies. I think that's one answer to your question. The second would be that we in the Netherlands, we have to, I face some severe budget cuts, so we're going to go down on your list, unfortunately. So there's a few things one can do. One can kind of maintain all the priorities and take something off of each of them, or one can think, where is the added value that we can supply? Now, many countries, and thankfully, are investing in education. For example, the Global Partnership for Education is one of the organizational frameworks that we have for that. Now, I pulled out of education, not because I don't think it's important. I do think it's important, but all governments in the world invest in education. But there are only a few that dare to invest in sexual and reproductive rights of women. So when one faces budget cuts, then the choice is easy I thought it was easy. So, but not everyone agrees, coming to your second question. Let me first say a few words about the reactions of civil society in the Netherlands. Those reactions were mixed. Partly because some of the budget cuts are also affecting the commitment that we have to support civil society. And of course, I mean, I wouldn't be too happy if I saw my budget cut. On the other hand, when I talk with them about the content of the dialogue, of the policy, I would say there's lots of support for that. Also because I asked them to support the policy in strengthening their watchdog role. If you want to engage in inclusive growth, and I think that's something that you also mentioned, David, you need watchdogs. You need civil society to be able to say, you know, the larger businesses are not living up to all the requirements that we think that they have to, or local communities are not engaged, or women are not engaged enough. So I think they are very supportive of that agenda, moving away a bit from service delivery, again, because there's many other donors who are willing and able to contribute to that, and moving into a little bit more the political arena, if you wish, also in terms of protecting human rights. Many countries within the EU are very interested in this new policy. And the larger public, I would say, loves it. And one of the things that we've been neglecting a bit, or maybe haven't been able to really relate to, is how the general public looks in times of austerity in our own countries. Looks upon the traditional development aid, and by combining trade and aid and bringing it, well, also to the private sector in the Netherlands. I mean, there is a mercantilist, if you wish, switch to it. But I think they are very much supportive for that, and that I kind of like it, because I've been in this arena for a long time, and it's been such a struggle to convince people that what we are doing is effective. And that they should contribute to it, because I think it's effective. I really enjoy the conversations I have with people who are not very into this business, so to say, and who really see the opportunities for themselves and for others. There are tensions, though. I mean, it will not be an easy ride. You spoke about trade policies. The good thing is that, because I'm a Minister of Trade and Aid, I'm also involved in WTO and in the TTIP negotiations from the EU side. And there's some trade-offs there, we should be frank about them also. But those tensions would have been there anyway, if I would have a new policy or not, or if there would be a colleague who would be doing the international trade component. So I would say let us confront them and look into. I was very interested in this research that says that TTIP would not be very much supporting third world economies or developing countries' economies. That would be an interesting thing for me to take up, also in the WTO and in the EU. So there's lots of opportunities there, I would say.
Great. Well, thank you very much, and I certainly appreciate your willingness to take some tough decisions. Not easy to do. So I have one question for both David and Joshua. And it's the following, and I think the minister already set it up quite nicely for me to go into this, which is that this, the joining up of the aid, trade, and investment streams in this new strategy of the government of Netherlands presents some opportunities and also some risks. And I just wanted to ask each of you how you saw those opportunities and risks. And I thought it was interesting that Josh talked about trade as a vehicle for development, might be one way to take a look at it, and David talked about possibly a mercantilist approach that may be surfacing in this agenda. So is there a risk that commercial interests might overshadow development impact? And David, beyond if the aid budget is going to decline, obviously that's going to affect Netherlands' ranking on the Commitment to Development Index. But putting that aside, what do you think would be the impact of this new strategy on how Netherlands fares in that index? Maybe we'll start with Josh.
Okay, thanks. Look, it's a difficult question, and I think it will be interesting to see actually how the Dutch do manage this process. I think that from a trade policy perspective, you know, you get very used to the expectation that there's always going to be a mercantilist element to it. It's a reality of the political economy of trade negotiations. I think that, you know, the minister's outlined how there can be some very strong synergies between the aid agenda and then the trade agenda. And so I think, you know, on one hand, from a sort of institutional perspective, there might be the opportunity to actually build that out into a more coherent policy. So you might actually find that, for instance, the you know, where you get, say, the resistance, I mean, this is going to have to be refracted through the EU process, obviously, more broadly, but where you get resistance to, say, further market access openings, if you can encourage, though, the more export-orientated businesses to push for that type of quid pro quo, which is kind of part of trade negotiations, combined with an aid program which also supports how developing countries actually open to markets and can take advantage of that, then you actually might get some very positive outcomes on that front. I think, you know, it's also the case that, you know, for instance, if you look at how the developing country approaches, say, worked in WTO context, and particularly the granting of preferential market access to developing countries, you know, it's a mixed outcome in many respects. I think it's produced some, you know, economic gain to those countries which have the preferences, but even for those countries, there is now, I think, a realisation that they at times have been locked into particular commodities, and the preferences are often voluntary in the sense that they're not actually legally binding. They can be wound back, and actually in the context of a multilateral round can actually put developing countries at a disadvantage. So, you know, to some extent, if not moving away from that, but broadening that out into a greater understanding that this is not only about creating new market access opportunities, but also helping developing countries embed themselves into global value chains through their own liberalisation process, which might be more effectively pushed with a joint ministry. I mean, that would be my hope.
Great. Dave?
Yes, I do think there is a risk, although how great it is in terms of the mercantilist kind of pressure is impossible for me to judge because I don't know enough about the details. I think, you know, in the investment component of the index, which is one where the Netherlands, I think, may actually be tied for first place right now, we have no penalty or reward for having an export credit agency. Most of the countries we score have this, where it provides typically low-interest loans for countries, for corporations wanting to, you know, export aircraft or what have you to developing countries. And we leave it out because we think that that has become very heavily mercantilist, and it's become a kind of race to the bottom. And the result often is, because of these heavy subsidies for developed country corporations, is that it undercuts development of those industries in poorer countries. On the other hand, we do reward support offering of political risk insurance, so that if a Dutch corporation wants to invest in Indonesia, it can get insurance from the Dutch government to protect it from the nationalization of its assets in Indonesia. So we're trying to strike a balance between, on the one hand, supporting constructive engagement across borders, but not going so far that it starts to undermine what seems like healthy development in developing countries. And where you draw that line is often very hard, but that illustrates the kind of risk and conflict that is present in some of these policies. I don't expect that the policies that are described here will affect the Dutch performance on the CDI, on the Commitment to Development Index, aside from, as you mentioned, the reduction in the aid budget. And there's a broader message there, which I think has some anchoring in the real world, is that some of the big factors like openness to migration, what we're doing to the atmosphere, support for research and development are going to matter more than a lot of the policies that are being discussed here.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I think we're right on time, and we have about 20 minutes to hear from all of you. So what I would like you to do, I think there's going to be a microphone that's coming around. Please put up your hands so the microphone can come to you. Introduce yourself, if you will. And I would appreciate it if there's a question mark at the end of the sentence. And please do indicate if you wish a particular individual on the panel to respond. If not, that's okay. Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Myrthe Postuma. I work for an organization here in D.C. that works on rule of law issues in Latin America. And my question is mainly for the minister. It has two parts. I focus on Latin American and rule of law issues, and my experience in those countries that are mostly middle-income countries, but that have relatively weak democratic institutions. Honduras had a coup only in 2009, and countries that suffer from a lot of violence, too, is that in those countries there's a lot of pressure by economic elites and economic powers on democratic institutions and on the judiciary, for example. Mm-hmm. What will you do to make sure that strengthening the private sector will not exacerbate those differences? The second part of my question has something to do with that, too, and that I think in a lot of those countries, one of the big problems is a weakness of the state and a weakness of the institutions. I think in part because it's difficult to collect enough taxes, and especially economic elites and the private sector are big tax evaders. Mm-hmm. Free trade areas are created to attract foreign investors, but there's a little like flowing back into the country. How will you address those issues in the policy?
Any others? Yes, please. If you don't mind, we'll take a few, and then I'll turn to you.
Mahfouz Tadros, former World Bank. I have been in the development game for 40 years, probably a long time, but I learned a lot. Are we confusing the poor countries? Are donors confusing the poor countries? By every few years, they come up with a different theme. When I worked for the World Bank, all these cross-cutting themes were there. And now the Dutch minister comes and tells me, look, education, somebody else will do it. We will focus on something else. I hope that donors are coordinating at the global level, at the regional level, and most importantly, at the local level, so you don't confuse the people who are really doing the work. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Frank Heemskerk. I'm from the World Bank in development world since 2 months. I have a question to Joshua. I really liked your analysis that in global trade flows, it's much more about the global value change. So it's import-export for a country is very, very important to be part of that global value chain. Could you give examples of good policy initiatives, good government initiatives, with the private sector, which you would like to share to the minister, on strengthening these global value change, in particular for the emerging or the upcoming or the middle income or the lower income countries?
Good. One more.
Yeah. I'm Patrick Oberman. I'm a former business guy who works with nonprofits. Before anybody congratulates themselves on $1.25 as being some sort of number that's relevant, maybe it was in 1988, but I think you need to double that and then get your 2 billion people again. The other thing is very interesting, the two questions. One, the minister, I was very surprised that one of your top four categories wasn't energy, because if you don't have energy as part of the policy, then you don't have development. And the other thing for the two gentlemen, there was a lot of focus on agricultural importation and barrier reduction by the West. My experience has been that agriculture and raw material importation does nothing to develop these countries, that the resources that are under the umbrella of agriculture and mineral resource production are in the hands of a very few people that enrich very few people. And unless you take a country like Chile that's a large exporter of copper and teach them to make a motor, you're not getting any development in that country. And I say that because they don't make a motor in Chile, but they're one of the largest copper producers. So these are the kinds of things that I think you need to look at in a different way.
Okay, why don't we turn to the panel, and then we can do another round if there are more questions in the audience. So quite a few questions for you, Madam Minister. It's on the rule of law. In particular, do you see potential for exacerbating this difficult question by your policy of strengthening the hand of the private sector, if you will? And then how do you go about ensuring that there is a robust taxation capability in governments? I think from a number of perspectives, it's seen as something that strengthens that accountability link between governments and citizens, but also obviously generates resources for all kinds of public goods. Question about priorities, energy, why is that not there? And are we confusing poor developing countries? Then Joshua, specifically a question addressed to you on do you have good examples on encouraging global supply chains? Would a reduction in the barriers to trade on agricultural goods actually encourage development? David, you might want to pick up on any of those as well. We'll start with the minister.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Myrta, for your questions. Looking at the patterns of poverty, I think what we should be saying is that inequalities within countries are getting bigger, not so much between countries, but within countries. And in countries where there's not a very strong and solid government, economic elites can really, hamper development. And that's why I emphasize the importance of inclusive economic growth. I don't believe in trickle-down effects. I mean, not only because of those elites, but in generally speaking, I don't think it has been proven that that will work. So looking at private sector development, looking at good governance within private sector development or in water management, looking at a watchdog role for NGOs, I mean, those would be the ways in which I would like to contribute for that not happening, actually. But it's and I also think we have to be modest here. I mean, we're in the top 10 of this index, which I'm very proud of, but that doesn't mean that we will be solving all problems to all people and all countries. But it is certainly something that I'm very much aware of. Your second question on taxation, thank you for bringing that up. We've been investing for the past year and will continue to do so, working with, for example, the OECD on tax inspectors without borders, in building the capacity of taxation systems in developing countries. We will do that in the 15 countries that we focus on. Also engaging our own Department of Finance. Our own tax inspectors will go out and help build capacity. Now, globally speaking, the issue of taxation has been on the agenda, finally, I would say, for the past months, and it won't go away. Many NGOs have been advocating for that for a very long time. And I'm very happy to see that, globally speaking, this is on the agenda. The G20 has taken it upon themselves to look into it. OECD is doing research. Tackling that issue requires a level playing field, and it really requires a global commitment. So, taxation is really key, I would say. Then, yeah, well, energy is not there. Yeah, well, there's many issues that are not on my agenda, and that comes back to what I was saying, that, you know, I can't be everything to all people, and I have to be very precise in where we are putting our resources, which is not to say that in terms of geopolitical concerns, we are neglecting energy. Looking at the issues in many countries in Africa, I think infrastructure is very important. For children to be able to do their homework in the evening, you do need electricity. There are several programs where we are contributing to that. We're also working, obviously, I continue to work with the World Bank and other UN agencies who are focusing on those issues. Coordination, are we coordinating? Yes, we are, but also let's face the facts. Everyone thinks coordination is very important and no one wants to be coordinated. So I try to be an exception to the rule. Working with others, also where we are phasing out, for example, on education programs, looking for opportunities with other donors for them to take that upon themselves. I'm a believer in local coordination because I think that's also a way to empower local communities, not us behind our desks in, you know, the Washington DCs of this world. I do agree, and I feel your pain, so to say, when you say, you know, is this not another hype? I do hope it's not. I do hope it's really a new way of looking at a new world. And maybe can I say something about the global value chains? One of the things that we have been doing for quite some time is we have a center for promoting imports from developing countries, because I really do agree with you that trade policy is not about facilitating export only. It's also about facilitating import, taking down tariffs and non-tariff barriers. And we're also, and I think this has been in operation for, I think, 5 or 6 years now. We are supporting and we set up an initiative on sustainable trade that exactly looks at global value chains on soy, on cocoa, on coffee, on what have you, because we feel that global value chains will be one of the connectors in this agenda.
Great. Josh.
Thanks for your question. Part of this gets back to what the Minister was talking about in terms of enabling environments, and maybe a couple more specific things. I think a very important complement when you look at some countries as being what David's been a bit talking about is the investment environment, because increasingly we see that trade is between companies or it's between suppliers, and so it's either going to be about creating the opportunities for investors to go in and create parts of the supply chain, and that's going to be about investment liberalisation, rule of law. It's also going to be about infrastructures that you can have ports and roads so you can actually move goods around. But I think also importantly, it's been about developing countries making sort of strategic decisions about the way that they utilise the resources they have in abundance. So if you look at the Chinese example, for instance, you know, essentially you had accession to the WTO in 2001, significant trade liberalisation, but also, you know, importantly, there was investment liberalisation under certain areas, for instance, the GATS, the services bit, and where China basically managed to utilise enormous pools of very cheap labour to get into various manufacturing entities. Now, I think that one of the challenges for this model going forward is going to be possibly a gradual shift into manufacturing actually being increasingly skills intensive. There's the so-called additive manufacturing, and it's unclear how that is going to revolutionise manufacturing. But those type of comparative advantages, in a sense, may actually be less valuable. If you look, and I think what this then suggests is that going forward for countries getting into the global value chain, it's going to be increasingly about getting into the services end. And that's going to be about having skills and education policies, right? So I think the other example here might be India, which has got poor infrastructure. but has managed to build an IT hub in Bangalore and the rest. And so then we get into services policy and opening up markets to trade services. And I think if countries, that space is going to be where there's going to be a lot of value add for developing countries in global value chains going forward.
David, anything you want to think about?
A few thoughts. One, I want to endorse your argument for specialization. Mm-hmm. I think a plea was made for coordination, but as you said, no one wants to really coordinate. And I think one of the most realistic ways to coordinate is to specialize. And so I think it's very good that you've recognized that Netherlands, in a sense, has a comparative advantage in reproductive rights and sexual health and so on. And that there, and you represent probably 2% of global ODA, something like that. And there are lots of other people who can do education. And so there was a question about, does openness to agricultural trade really make a difference? And I think that's a great question because it's something that deserves critical inquiry for sure. And I wouldn't want to suggest any simplistic answer to that question. You mentioned copper mines. I think one should be skeptical about whether that's openness to copper trade is particularly good for development, but obviously that's not agriculture. Within agriculture, I think you're going to see a diversity of impacts, and it depends on the economic structure and the political economy of particular crop industries in particular countries. So if we're talking about openness to imports of palm oil, obviously that can be quite destructive if it's coming from through deforestation from Indonesia. There are other examples, though, where it seems like the barriers are harmful. There was a documentary some years ago, maybe it was called Dollar a Day, I can't remember. It had an episode which very powerfully juxtaposed depiction of the lives of some cotton farmers, I think in Oklahoma, who were receiving on the order of $50,000 to $100,000 a year in subsidies for their crop, and were effectively in direct competition on global markets with cotton farmers, I think in Mali, who were scraping by literally on a dollar a day. And that seemed pretty unjust.
Good. We can take perhaps one or two more questions if there are any. No, we've exhausted everybody's questions. Fantastic. Then I would simply like to end by thanking our panelists. In particular, thank you very much, Madam Minister, for coming and giving us the opportunity to pick apart your new strategy. Having said that, I wish you the best of luck in doing that, and I do applaud you for your courage. And thank you to David and Josh as well for your fantastic comments. Thanks. And thanks to you.